From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 17th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the Senior Grains Analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In agricultural news, the WTO has appointed a three-member panel to rule on the United States country of origin labeling legislation. China is set to accept shipments of U.S. pork, and Russia's grain lobby wants a bigger part of the world grain export market in order to relieve burdensome internal supplies. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories later in the half hour. Speaking of wheat exports, in the second half hour of our program today on many of these stations and online at willag.org, we'll talk with Steve Mercer of U.S. Wheat Associates. That group is dedicated to promoting the export of U.S. produced wheat. And it all happens right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago, on this Monday afternoon, futures finish the day like this. Nearby July wheat at 469 for the soft red, 2.5 lower. September at 486 and a quarter, down 2.5, and December at 517 and a half, down 2 cents. In Kansas City, the hard red July at $4.90, down a penny. July corn in Chicago, remember the May contracts expired on Friday. July corn at 356 settlement price, down 7. September at 364, down 6 and a quarter. December 373 and three quarters, down 6 and a quarter. And the March contract at 386 and a half, down 6 cents. May futures at 395 and a quarter, down 5 3/4. July soybean futures, $9.41, 12.5 cents the loss. August down 12 1/4 at 9.35 1/4. September soybeans, 9.20 3/4, down 10 3/4. And the November futures at 9.16 1/2, down 9 3/4. January contract of 2011 in the bean pit at 9.25 1/2, down 9.5 cents. July bean meal at 273.90, down 2.90. The August at 270.60, down 220. July oil at 37.13, down 38 cents. June live cattle, 92.50, 75 cents lower. May feeders at 109.65, down 57.5. And June lean hogs at 81.50, down $2 and a nickel on this Monday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. June crude oil futures, $70.28 a barrel, down $1.33. June ethanol at $1.60 3/10, down $0.01 6/10. Natural gas at $4.40 4/10 of a cent, up 9 2/10 of a cent. And heating oil at $1.99 3/10, down 6 7/10 for the day. Gold futures at $1,227.70 an ounce. A settlement price up 30 cents in the Dow now, just about 58 points lower at 10,562. The Goldman Sachs at 488.63 is down 12.94 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. It says moderate to locally heavy rainfall over the past weekend will keep fields too wet for any further planting in most locations through the end of this week. Western areas are likely to see the heaviest rainfall, but eastern areas will also experience work interruptions. That due, of course, to wet fields. Temperatures should remain below average through the work week. A return of warmer and drier weather will begin this weekend. Then until drying rates will be slow and crop development rates will also be hampered. Flooding has been reported along the Mississippi River. Scattered locations in northern Illinois and along the Illinois River are near flood stage, and the wet start to the week could result in some low-lying fields being flooded out. But conditions should slowly improve as we move through the week. The temperatures will be low in the beginning of the week, and by the time we get to the weekend, should be hot and steamy, with highs in the 80s. We'll have a more complete look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. You are, of course, listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
On this Monday afternoon, it is time to check in on the agricultural futures markets. Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, is here. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, a bit ugly in the bean pit for the day, down, what, 12 cents? And then if you look over at the Dow, it's down 55. The crude oil was off $1.22 today. And in that $70 range now, bottoming out there. What do you think of the marketplace?
Well, trying to stabilize the crude oil market. There's talk that OPEC's hitting maybe $65 crude. We took June down to $69.27, so anywhere between here and there, maybe we'll find some support there. As far as the stock indexes go, still watching some of these world events and see if some of these European countries can show signs of stability. I mean, the news is going to be real touchy here for a week or two until the trade gets comfortable what's going on in the world and we see investor confidence comes back in. But a little closer to home here on the grain market, the corn market did move down to near the lows we established here over the last 2 months, and beans the same thing. So it's a matter whether or not we can hold those previous lows. From a speculative point of view, we're down here. We're probably could be bought for a little bit of a pop. From a producer's point of view, with the uncertainty in the world and favorable growing conditions, it does suggest that there is still considerable downside risk. The biggest fear from a producer's point of view, if things would unravel overnight in the European market or Asian market, and we come in here in the morning and see the grain market to gap lower here, which would leave a big congestion period there that will be hard to go back and fill the opening gap from. So it's a tough market. As we all know, as the market goes down, we never have enough sold. And when it goes up, we've always have too much sold. So it's a challenge in here, and there's going to be a lot of factors affect this market, which is going to make volatility go up from here until middle of July.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Europe and the impact it has on the marketplace in Chicago, on the grains and the oil seeds. Why does that happen to begin with?
Well, it's the fear that the whole world economy is built on a deck of cards, or we could see a domino effect happen. The severity of it depends if it affects you personally or not, and it's one of those situations where credit was extended a little too much, and so it's just going to take time to get things back in order. The European situation, we had a group of countries go together and develop a common currency so you wouldn't have to exchange currency traveling from country to company and try to unite as one, but it's tough to get several countries agree, so they're in sort of turmoil here. Whether or not that holds together, we're going to find out. There's various opinions, but when somebody's in trouble that big and it could affect others and you just remove the confidence, there's that atmosphere that, man, that could spread, and so therefore you sort of see the speculative crowd, which has been heavily supportive in the grain market here over the last few years, sort of put their hands in the pocket here for a minute or two to see what unfolds.
Well, if things, tell me how things might unfold both ways. If it looks like they're going to come back out of it, what happens in the commodity markets, in your opinion? And what happens if they fold?
Well, if they fold, it's going to limit buying on ideas. We'll see demand go to that country. If you're a grain seller, it's going to be kind of hard to line credit up or sell to somebody where there's not available credit or uncertainty, so we'll lose that demand to that sector, which is not as big as our Asian demand. So the main thing is to make sure our Asian demand stays intact. So that's going to be the concern there if they do fold. But also, too, in the same breath, for the first time in 28 years, I've been in the marketplace over a week ago week and a half ago when this thing started folding, I did see buying interest come into the grain market, flight to quality. From the point is, you cannot eat gold or drink crude oil. And I think that's kind of huge in a sense that that could unfold and be a play as we move down the road. But the main thing is you don't like to see anybody fail. And the key is working out a solution and get these world economies back on stable ground.
Early in our conversation, you talked about some downside marks. Do you have places that you think the marketplace might go for corn, soybean, and wheat?
Well, we need to hold these lows of where we're at. That's sort of step one. If we cannot hold these lows, there are support levels on the charts at some lower levels. Our fear is, fundamentally, if there's no urgency to be a buyer here, if weather's cooperative, if demand doesn't pick up, we break the support level, there's ideas that the corn market can drift another 50 cents lower from here. We could take July futures down to the $3 benchmark and December futures down to $3.25. In the bean sector, it's going to be important for these July beans to hold $9.30 and these Novembers to hold $9. If not, there's probably another 50 cents to 75 cents downside risk there. In the wheat market, same thing here, July wheat futures at 460, 450, failure to hold that would suggest maybe 425. Now, there are some Elliott Wave guys, some technicians that see downside risk in corn another $1 from here and beans another $2 from here.
I take it you don't agree with that.
I hope not. I hope not.
Well, let's go back to the fundamentals. What do they tell you fundamentally in the marketplace? Can we rally in any real way?
We can have some ups in here. You know, fundamentally, you know, with big acres, crop in fairly decent shape in most of the growing regions, that there's no urgency to step up and stand in the line to be a buyer. We've got ample domestic supplies. We've got ample world supplies. And in that case, what the seasonality tells us is we sort of drift lower as we go into the first mid part of summer. Then we'll see what the summer weather brings. And at that point in time, you know, if we do get some weather concerns, we can have some more up then. But it feels to me as if we're following tradition here that no real weather threat in the world, that we could sort of see this market trend sideways or lower here over the next month or two.
We do appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Very good. Thanks.
And that's Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. Happens each and every Monday afternoon.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Please do take the time to visit our website if you get the opportunity. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our daily ag programming. It's free to listen to, and it's in its whole identity online. We don't take anything out there. If you want to listen to programs, you can do it anytime you want at willag.org. Dave Dickey's here now with today's Ag News.
In agricultural news, World Trade Organization Director General Pascal Lamy has appointed a three-member panel to rule on a complaint filed by Canada and Mexico against U.S. country of origin labeling requirements for meat and perishable commodities. At issue is a provision of the 2008 Farm Bill that imposes mandatory country of origin labeling for beef, pork, lamb, chicken, and goat meat, and certain perishable commodities sold at retail outlets in the U.S. Canada and Mexico claim the COOL requirements lead to discrimination against their meat producers within the U.S. market. China will finally begin accepting shipments of U.S. pork about 3 months after an agreement was reached between the two countries. A U.S. government official says that the delay getting a resumption of actual trade was mostly a matter of complex paperwork to satisfy China. The paperwork was finished on April 15th. China banned U.S. pork last year over concerns about the H1N1 influenza virus. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke urged China today to roll back policies that promote the development of clean energy and other technology in China at the expense of foreign firms. Locke says American companies were surprised when Beijing rolled out policies for promoting clean energy and other technology without foreign input. Locke says the proposals would harm rather than stimulate China's innovation environment by limiting foreign direct investments and imports from abroad that have the potential to deliver new products and services to the Chinese people. The head of Russia's grain lobby says that Russia will try to raise its grain exports in 2010-2011 by offering low prices. Russia will have record carryover grain stocks of 26 million tons by July 1st, compared with 22.6 million tons a year ago. A PRC official from the State Administration of Grain says that China has an adequate supply of corn with supply exceeding demand. The administration's deputy director told the official news agency in an interview that China's central grain reserves were large, but prices had risen recently because people were aware that the 2009 harvest in the Northeast was smaller than the previous years and had stocked up, while speculators had also pushed up prices. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of this program, The Closing Mark Report, and a program we called The Farming World. Our guest today coming up in the second half hour on many of these stations is U.S. Wheat Associates' Steve Mercer. Stay with us if you can, or visit willag.org to hear the interview. Now, up next, you know, the FarmDoc website from the Ag Economist here on campus at the U of I has been effectively pushing the technological outreach envelope since it began. I'll have more because there always seems to be something new and useful there for farmers to try. FarmDoc stands for Farm Decision Outreach Center. It's a website started a few years ago so that the ag economist at the University of Illinois could deliver information directly to end users, mostly farmers, landowners, and farm managers. It quickly evolved into a way to deliver tools and information. The first tools were downloadable Microsoft Excel spreadsheets that farmers could use as templates and calculators for all types of farm management. Then came the online calculators and comparison spreadsheets for things like crop insurance. And now there are webinars. It's a way for the ag econ specialist, like Gary Schnittke, to post educational material in a PowerPoint with hot links and his voice. He just did one on the government's acre program.
Yeah, we make these acre webinars. Actually, they start out with a PowerPoint overhead set, and we put animation in it. And then we have a plug-in or a program in addition to PowerPoint called Articulate that you voice it over. And as we get more experience with those acre web or that piece of software and the webinar format, we can do a lot of things with animation and voicing over that make hopefully them interesting and fast-paced, and you can always repeat it so that you can see the information.
That ability to go back and listen and watch again is more than just a nicety.
Yep, the webinars are built such that each slide or has a button off the left, and you can click and do them over again. So I think that's a nice setup, I believe.
A setup you can experience for yourself if you have internet access. Just visit the FarmDoc website at farmdoc.illinois.edu. There you'll find several webinars. Schnitke's latest is a review of the ACRE program. It's projected 2009 and 2010 crop year payouts and offers some insight into whether or not a farmer should sign up for the program for the first time this year. Well, here's a hint. The answer is yes for all the Corn Belt states. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on this Monday afternoon. Matt Payne joins us from the Andersons right here in Champaign County to take a look at the cash grain market. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Rainy afternoon. Anybody actually hauling corn in today?
We've been painfully slow here today, both on hauling in and market-wise. Another down day, so not too much activity.
Yeah, not much activity, I suspect. They're thinking about locking their bin doors back up at least until, what, June now, at least?
I would agree, yes, yes. Guys are, you know, wringing their hands, hoping to get in the last couple of days they need to do beans, and then everyone will be in good shape. There really isn't too many people that still have some corn left in the bin, so it should be pretty mild on hauling anyway for a while.
Yeah, you mentioned that they'll be wringing their hands about that last percentage or so of beans.
Yep.
Most everything's planted?
Absolutely. I think really our state numbers probably haven't changed at all in this past week just because the rain, it seems to be about 2 days wet, 2 days dry, and then we get more rain. So I don't expect state numbers to change too much. National may be up just a hair, but I think 2 good days and most people should be finished up with beans the way it sounds.
I suspect you've been watching the Gulf of Mexico, the oil spill, and
absolutely
keeping a tab on what that may or may not mean. Have we got a better idea of what that means at this point to the export market?
As of now, it's unchanged. We've been very fortunate that they've been able to contain it, and it seems like hauling and exporting has been going as scheduled. There really has been no changes that anyone has mentioned. There's been a couple of ships that have been rerouted to Houston for unloads, but nothing has changed for exports.
And what kind of a worst-case scenario people banter around?
That the river would be temporarily closed. It happened in 2008, so we know how what can happen. The freight market will go up, and which kind of brings basis levels down locally. But as of now, we've had no issues, which has been a good thing. We increased our bean bid 2 cents today to 10 under, so we're seeing that it's improving a little bit every week, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, bean bid should it stay pretty strong from this point forward, I
we
would
agree,
think?
Just because there really isn't a whole lot of beans floating around, especially central part of the U.S., and processors are still calling for them, so that's a good thing.
And what are your bids for the day?
Right now, cash corn is 344, June delivery 346, fall 344, Dece 354. Beans cash bid 931, June 931, fall bid 876, and December 890.
Thanks much, Matt.
Thank you.
Matt Payne with the Andersons. More in 2 minutes here on the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tom Testel and Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the European Union's top financial official says he will draft new rules to create more oversight of derivatives trading, blamed by some for worsening the financial crisis. Financial Services Commissioner Michael Barnier says the new rules could mean fines for market abuse in what has been largely unregulated trading. Barnier said at a Monday press conference that he would draft a separate law to regulate credit default swaps, a type of insurance against a borrower going bankrupt that have become a lucrative market for traders. General Motors Company today says it rode cost cuts and strong sales of new models to its first quarterly profit in nearly 3 years. GM says it earned $865 million from January through March. The $1.66 per share profit was far better than a loss of $6 billion or $9.78 per share for the same period last year. Hunt's brand manager Ryan Torrenson says that ConAgra Foods has removed high fructose corn syrup from its Hunt's brand ketchup. Torrenson says that shoppers have been shying away from high fructose corn syrup due to health concerns, and it was consumer demand that drove the change. And the euro today slumped to a four-year low as investors dumped the single currency on sovereign debt worries and on fears that recent belt tightening measures would hurt a recovery in the eurozone area. And that's a look at today's business news.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The folks at Chesapeake Energy are out of the office this afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the Midwest today. Dense cloudiness, some drizzle, bit of scattered showers, a few thunderstorms. They'll produce unusually cool afternoons today and tomorrow. High temperatures in the upper 50s and 60s. Rain will overspread most of Illinois and Indiana today, with somewhere between a half and an inch and a quarter likely from central Illinois to northern Indiana and northern Ohio. Temperatures improving in the weather as we go through Tuesday and Wednesday. No rain expected. It will be warmer, of course. However, sunshine will be extremely limited, with northwestern Illinois and Iowa most favored for sunshine. The Iowa precip will be minimal this week. Showers likely in the southeast today. Those return briefly on Thursday and Friday to the I-State in the west as scattered showers. Rains will return to Illinois and Indiana, the other two I-States, Thursday and Friday, with another 2/10 to 3/4 inch likely. And then high pressure will build into the Midwest this weekend. That'll suppress the rainfall and create a very steamy environment with high humidity and temperatures reaching into the 80s, a bit south in the Delta region of the nation. Today for Nashville, 77 degrees, 35% chance of thunderstorms, and then tomorrow they'll cool down. Partly sunny, 69 degrees. Wednesday, 73 degrees. Thursday, 79 is their highs. Lows in the 50s, they'll have about a 10% chance of rainfall later in the week. Other growing regions around the nation will check in on the wheat crop in Ukraine. Kiev, temperatures today, a high this afternoon, or rather this evening, of 48 degrees. And then tomorrow it'll be sunny, 66, sunshine, and no rainfall for the forecast at all in that growing region of the world, although it tends to be a bit drier. High in the upper 70s the rest of the week, lows in the 50s there. If we check in on the corn-growing regions of China in Jilin, that's in the northeastern quadrant of that nation, it looks like just about here for the weather forecast. There are lows around 50, 54 degrees, highs in the upper 60s to the low 70s, right on through Thursday. And then Friday, like here, they'll warm up and get around 80 degrees for the weekend. So those are some of the growing regions as we check in on those around the planet. Be sure to stay with us if you can this afternoon. For the farming world, our guest today will be Steve Mercer. He's with U.S. Wheat Associates out west, and we'll talk about the export market for wheat and a bit about GMO and how to incorporate genetically modified crops into the wheat mix. That hasn't been done yet. You might want to stay with us if you can. That'll happen on some of these radio stations. For the rest of you, we'll say goodbye. If you'd like to hear the program, you can always do that on willag.org. That's our website, WILL.org.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with the Director of Communications for the U.S. Wheat Associates. His name is Steve Mercer. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Mr. Mercer, if you could tell me first, what's the mission of the U.S. Wheat Associates?
Well, you know, officially our goal, our mission is to develop, maintain, and expand international markets to enhance wheat producer profit here in the U.S. So we do that by working with overseas buyers, providing a number of services to them to make it easier for them to purchase U.S. wheat. And that's important because year to year, we export about half of the wheat produced here in the U.S.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, we have 15 offices around the world and two offices here in the U.S. And really, we work directly with the, in some cases, government buyers, but mainly private purchasers of wheat. So we're working with flour millers. We're working with wheat food processors in about 100 countries. And we have permanent staff, which is somewhat different than some of the cooperator organizations with USDA, in that we feel that relationships are really important. We work directly with these folks, and essentially we try to help them find ways to use U.S. wheat to really improve their enterprises, to increase their profit, and to do a better job introducing new products that that are primarily based on flour developed, processed from U.S. wheat.
You are funded in part through checkoffs?
That's correct. There are 19 state wheat checkoffs around the country, and those state commissions that manage those funds are members of U.S. wheat. So we have state commission members. They are assessed funding that we suggest. It's perfectly voluntary. I think in most cases, state checkoffs are, it's voluntary for producers to provide that money. They can petition to get their checkoff back. That doesn't happen much, but so we're funded by those assessments, and then that qualifies us for funding from the federal government, specifically from USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. And the programs that we use primarily are the Market Access Program and the Foreign Market Development Program. Those programs, you know, really that public-private partnership has been extremely successful over many years. Of course, it was developed in the 1950s when we had a lot of grain commodity production, a lot of supplies, and needed to find ways to sell it overseas. So, you know, in this case, this is a government program that really pays a lot of dividends back to U.S. producers. Specifically for wheat producers, most recently we did an evaluation of the reward that the return that comes back from that investment. And we worked with a nationally known university professor who has done a number of studies on the value that accrues back to producers from programs like ours. So using that model, which is proven, what we found is that for every dollar that producers provide to U.S. wheat. Now, that includes direct funding from the checkoff as well as in-kind contributions. For every dollar, $23 comes back to the producers directly in net revenue increase. And that increase comes from higher prices for wheat. But the benefits go beyond just producers. When you look at the investment that is made in the work that U.S. Wheat does, we saw in this study that about $150 come back to the U.S. economy. And, of course, that would be the wheat supply chain, all the way from the private exporters at the export locations to the transportation system to country elevators and back to producers. So this is a very, very successful public-private partnership.
How much is the checkoff? I know it's on the first sale of the bushel of wheat, but how much is that checkoff?
It does vary by state. Each individual state has their own methods of collecting, and it varies from maybe a quarter penny up to maybe 2 cents a bushel in some cases, so it does vary. It runs, the direct contribution runs about just about $5 million total that comes to U.S. Wheat, and an additional $5 million comes in through in-kind contributions. So, you know, our state organizations will host trade teams that we bring, and that is expenses that they incur directly. So, you know, total producer contribution is about $10 million, and then the total contribution that we get from the market access program and foreign market development program and other government programs is about 10. So it's about $20 million. You know, this is an industry, the wheat exports, of course it varies according to price, but generally speaking, it is about you know, between $5 and $7 billion industry every year on average. So, for $20 million investment, bringing, you know, $5 to $7 billion back to the U.S. economy, that's money well spent.
How long have you been involved with the U.S. Wheat Associates?
I started with the organization back in 2006. We are, you know, our organization started as two separate legacy organizations, really back in 1959. So wheat export market development is over 50 years old. And then those two organizations was Western Wheat Associates and Great Plains Wheat merged in 1980. So this is actually U.S. Wheat's 30th year providing that mission to enhance producer profit through building markets for wheat producers.
How is it that you differ, for instance, from the National Association of Wheat Growers, or NAWG?
Yeah, well, basically, the National Association of Wheat Growers has a number of affiliate state organizations, and NAWG, is the acronym, is primarily focused on being the voice for producers here in Washington, D.C., and those individual state affiliates are speaking for producers in the state capitals. So they are, a simple way to put it would be, they are the lobbying organization, the domestic lobbying organization for wheat producers. They receive some funding from commissions, but the primary source of funding for NAWG and the state affiliates is through membership dues. So there is a misunderstanding in some cases that if you are paying your checkoff dollar for wheat, that makes you a member of the state affiliate and the National Association of Wheat Growers. That's not actually the case. So it's really important for producers who are making that choice to remember that to increase their voice domestically, they need to be members of those state associations and, of course, to represent their product overseas. The support for the checkoff is very important.
I understand that you're primarily involved with promoting exports of wheat outside of the United States. I'm wondering, though, how things have changed for your organization over the last, I don't know, 15 years since the 1996 Freedom to Farm Bill was put in place. wheat acres in some states have dropped dramatically in the United States. Mm-hmm. Kansas, for instance, a wheat state, is now a corn state. In Illinois, we're down to some 300,000 soft red winter wheat acres, and we were over a million at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that there's a very strong competition for acres going on. And, you know, we look at it primarily as corn, oilseed crops, soybeans, canola, et cetera, and wheat. And really what is driving that to a very large extent is first profitability, because generally speaking, corn, soybeans, other crops do tend to be more profitable than wheat. And what's driving that in part is biotechnology. The biotechnology traits have been a tremendous boon for those crops. Of course, you also have growing demand for ethanol for corn, but biotechnology traits have been very beneficial for those other crops. And of course, wheat currently has no biotechnology traits in the U.S., nor in the world, for that matter. Things are changing because in the last couple of years, U.S. wheat producers, and in fact, producers from Australia, Canada, a number of other countries, have decided that we need to open the crop to new technology, and specifically to biotechnology. So with that support from producers, the technology providers, public and private, are beginning to reinvest in wheat. And I think that we're still probably 5 to 10 years away from having biotechnology traits in wheat. But in the meantime, this new infusion of resources, cash specifically, we're very excited about that because I think we're going to see a number of traits, even from conventional breeding, that are going to improve the crop, not only the quality, of course, but yields as well for producers. I think the difference for wheat now is going to be that much of the trait technology research is really focused on not so much on herbicide resistance, somewhat less for insect resistance, but really the focus is on developing traits that allow wheat to produce to its maximum potential in drought situations, to use nitrogen more efficiently, and in some cases salt tolerance. In Australia, for example, there has been a number of years of drought trend and has caused salinization of the soil. So that is a huge problem there. Some of the other traits that we expect to begin to look at and see are going to be some disease resistance, scab, fusarium head blight can be a very significant problem in wheat. It in a wet year near harvest, as the wheat develops, it can be a pretty bad issue in Illinois, for example, in soft red winter, because fusarium is a similar, it affects corn as well. So the inoculum is always out there. So these are some of the things that we're looking at. And in the case of exports, we have a job to do as an industry and U.S. wheat specifically, to talk to our customers overseas about what that means and how that will change the wheat that is going to be offered into the world market.
You're listening to The Farming World. Our guest is Steve Mercer of the U.S. Wheat Associates. More when we return.
It's National Cherry Cobbler Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1733, England passed the Molasses Act, putting high tariffs on rum and molasses imported to the colonies from any place other than Britain and its possessions. In 1803, John Hawkins and Richard French patented a reaping machine. In 1886, John Deere died, an American inventor and manufacturer. He developed the first steel plow in the 1830s and founded John Deere and Company in 1868. As a blacksmith in a U.S. prairie town, he frequently repaired the wood and cast iron plows of Eastern U.S. design because the local soils were heavy and sticky. By 1838, he had produced steel plows of his own design. Deere realized that a plow with a highly polished surface could clean or scour itself as it moved through the field. In 1848, John Deere moved his operation to Moline, Illinois, to lower his costs by taking advantage of better transportation and water power provided by the Mississippi River. Within a few years, production had reached 1,600 plows a year, and Deere was getting his own special steel rolled to his specifications from mills in Pittsburgh. In 1897, Alvin Stackman was born. An American plant pathologist and educator, he established methods for identifying and combating diseases of wheat and other food crops. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with the Director of Communications for the U.S. Wheat Associates. His name is Steve Mercer. Mr. Mercer, when we left, you had just taken up the topic of biotechnology. It has not been incorporated into wheat. You suggest that'll happen in the next 10 years and some ways that that will happen. One of the jobs that U.S. Wheat Associates will have will be to convince the export market that it's okay to purchase wheat that has been genetically modified. What are those conversations like?
Yeah, I think among the conversations that we're having, you know, I think in some ways it's not so much trying to sell wheat with biotechnology traits as it is to help them identify ways to purchase the wheat that they want. We believe that the marketplace will create an opportunity to offer wheat that has biotechnology traits or was grown with biotechnology traits, and wheat that is non-GM, if you will. The critical question there becomes, around the world, how can we work with local regulatory officials and international standard setting bodies to accept a minimum tolerance of the presence for GM wheat. Once GM traits are produced commercially, there is the risk, of course, that it will be in any shipment, whether that shipment is non-GM or not. So we have to develop levels of minimum acceptance for that. And that's not the case in some areas right now. So that's one thing that's really critical. But we're helping our customers overseas understand that they will be able to buy the wheat that they want. Prices, you know, may change or very, various characteristics, but we're committed to providing choice to those customers overseas, but we're also committed to allowing our producers to use the technology that's available to produce the crop. And we believe that without developing biotechnology traits that have the potential to increase benefits to producers, to make wheat more profitable, that U.S. wheat production will continue to decline. I mean, where yields are going up somewhat, that offset those limited number of acres or a reduction in the number of acres that are being planted. But, you know, we see that separation beginning to happen over time if we're not able to compete with corn and soybeans for other acres.
Right. It's easy enough for consumers not to see corn and soybeans, I think, as a product that they consume directly, though it's in many of the products that they have and to eat and have for the last, you know, since 96, 95. Wheat is seen as bread. It's much more difficult, I would think, to enhance those products genetically and to have consumer acceptance. But when you talked about the traits that were in the pipeline potentially for wheat, they were the same types of traits that corn and soybeans would be working on. Those would be in the same category, I suppose, traits that would help production and not offer benefit that the consumer might see readily. Are there things that might be in the pipeline that the consumer would be more accepting of a genetically modified crop?
At this point, most of the work is being done on what I would term, as you put it, you know, producer benefit traits. Partly because if the producer can't benefit from biotechnology, the benefits are not going to go on forward to the end users. There is work being done. We know of a university in California has partnered with a technology provider to begin to look really closely at the issue of celiac disease, so gluten intolerance. And that's a combination of both biotechnology research but also conventional breeding. So that is one area that once the revenue that can accrue to the technology producers and to the wheat producers themselves, and then they move on to more consumer-oriented traits. Now, others will be, of course, could be shelf life for the flour, could be various characteristics that enhance the bread and other products. Initially it has to be producer benefit, but there definitely will be, as we move on, there will be consumer benefits as well.
Well, I have a secondary question. Are there states where producers ask for consumer benefits? And I would think that those would be states that don't see choice in alternative crops. So Montana, Wyoming, as opposed to maybe Kansas and Oklahoma and the Dakotas.
There's no doubt that consumer benefit traits will eventually be pursued. Absolutely. We believe that that's going to happen. There's a large number of organizations that are concerned mainly about supply, continued reliable supply, that are working together to try and find the most beneficial path forward for customers and for their own industries.
Mr. Mercer, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Steve Mercer is with U.S. Wheat Associates. He's been our guest here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Dave Dickey does our booking. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.